The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan. Have you ever thought to yourself, nothing, absolutely nothing can make me do something I don't want to do? Nobody, nothing. Even if you put something in my drink, can't make me do something I don't want to do. Well, that's what I used to think. I used to feel for sure that nothing could make me do something I didn't want to do. And then I started looking a little more honestly at myself, and I began to think, well, maybe that's not so. Maybe that's not so. Maybe if my brain were impaired, I might do things that ordinarily I would never, never do. I began to look more and more at the facts of the matter. If you give a drug in a psychiatric clinical trial, and let's say you give one of the SSRI antidepressants, Paxil or Zoloft or Celexa, Prozac, if you give the drug to 20 people, without telling them whether they're getting a drug or a sugar pill, and you give the drug to 20 other, you give the sugar pill to 20 other people without telling them whether you're giving them the drug or the sugar pill, that's a controlled clinical blind trial. You're going to find that the people on the sugar pill don't pretty much behave any differently than they usually would. That is, they're not going to have a lot of adverse drug effects or other weird behaviors coming up on the sugar pill. But the people who are getting the Paxil or the Prozac, a large percentage are going to behave differently. Some will get insomnia and have trouble sleeping. Some will get irritable and angry with their families. Some will get agitated. Some will even get manic. They will develop a psychosis, a manic psychosis where they do bizarre, out of control things they never, never, never would have done in ordinary life and wouldn't have imagined that would horrify them afterward. I do a lot of criminal work in cases where people have done horrible things that are unprecedented in their lives and closely timed to taking psychiatric drugs and closely patterned to the effects of the psychiatric drugs. So, that's my introduction to today's show. So if you think that someone who makes a claim that they did something horrible or violent and that it was because they were on a psychiatric drug and they didn't think that could happen to them and it just came over them, or if they did something bizarre and stupid and self-defeating, and you think, nah, not me, listen to today's show. Listen to my guest, Kevin McShane, a really fine young man who ran afoul of Paxil. I worked on his case. I'm not going to tell you anything more about his case right now. I'm going to let him get in on the story. Are you there, Kevin?
Dr. Bragan, hi.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing really, really good, and I'm very excited about having you on the show. I do think you're the first person I've had on the show who was a client in a criminal case. I wouldn't do this if you'd been a patient of mine, I wouldn't have you come on the show. But my having been hired by you to do legal work is very, very different than your having been my patient in terms of our relationship. It's a much more open relationship this way.
Yes.
So I'm happy to have you on the show. This is new for me. It will be unprecedented for almost anybody who listens to the show.
Okay.
So what did you think about my introduction?
Well, I was confronted with that myself. There is skepticism. No one wants to believe that they are not the master of their own domain and that they are not completely in control of their thoughts, actions, and behaviors, you know? So, you know, it came as a rude awakening to me that a substance of any kind could have the influence it had over my life. I've come to terms with that. And I understand it, and I've educated myself on the subject to the point where it makes complete sense to me how that happened. But I think there is a huge part of the public that does just not want to process that information, just does not want to believe it. And it's understandable why. No one wants to feel at risk. No one wants to feel that they're not controlling their own behavior and that a drug could completely alter their behavior. And you know, so I understand where that comes from. Because I, too, had the same thought process. So,
well, let me shock the audience and say that the young man you're listening to isn't so young anymore. Kevin McShane is just out of a 10-year jail sentence. So let me start you with that.
Mm-hmm.
And now, Kevin, why don't you pick up with the story about how all this happened?
Okay, well, I'll give the synopsized version as best I can because obviously there are a tremendous amount of details. But it all begins when I was 22 years of age and experiencing a slight depression. And this was a direct result of my behavior. This depression existed because I was immature. I was not living the life a 22-year-old young man should have been living. I was ignoring my responsibilities. What happened was I was beginning to accept the fact that this responsibility was mine and I could no longer point fingers and blame, and thus the decision to see a counselor or a psychiatrist became one in which I was moving towards what I considered to be the right direction. It was more also at the behest of my then girlfriend and mother, who, you know, advocates of counseling, you know, guided me towards that decision. So we didn't have, you know, any psychiatrist in mind. We kind of used our insurance to pick one. I went to see a psychiatrist and discuss what it was that was preventing me from, you know, moving into adulthood without all the friction that was apparently being caused. So, I never saw a psychiatrist. I never glimpsed a psychiatrist. I was immediately introduced to a nurse practitioner. Having very little experience with this, I didn't think anything odd about it. And within 15 minutes of speaking to this woman, I basically, you know, explained to her that I'm anxious. I'm anxious that my behavior now is going to have some sort of ripple effect on the rest of my life, and it's time for me to grow up. I'm slightly depressed, and I'm frustrated with myself, with my behavior, was the crux of what I told her. I think I should not have used the word anxious. I think I should have used the word concern, because when I used the word anxious, I think a light bulb went off and I was immediately given a starter kit for Paxil. Again, very little experience, young, naive, trusting of institutions. I didn't question the notion of a prescription very much. Definitely should have, but I didn't. Took the starter kit with me, but for 10 milligrams, 15 days. And another prescription for 20 milligrams when the starter kit ran out for 30 days. And didn't take the pills right away, whether it was simply forgetting or I just didn't make it a part of my daily routine. I eventually decided I was going to give it a try. Because what I said to myself at the time was, what's the worst that could happen? And, you know, famous.
And boy, you had no idea, did you?
Famous last words.
God.
I thought if anything, nothing would happen. It would have no effect. I had very little confidence that it would work at all. I think that had a lot to do with me not even trying it. I didn't understand the power and how strong these drugs were. I guess I was under the impression that anything that would be approved, FDA approved, would be watered down for some reason. It wouldn't be very strong. or else it would never be approved. If I ever consciously, I didn't ever consciously think that, but subconsciously that probably was in my mind. So I didn't think it would work, but I gave it a shot, and I made it a part of my routine where every morning I woke up, took one Paxil. And it wasn't even a thought process, you know, and that's what I did. Now, nothing immediately happens, and that's well known that antidepressants do not affect you within the first, 2 weeks to a month, depending on the person.
Well, let me say that's something of a myth, because the idea is that, you know, you got to wait 4 to 6 weeks for it to help you, but actually they can start hurting you with the first dose. But you didn't notice an effect with the first dose.
Well, not only did I not notice any effect, when I did eventually notice an effect, it was almost imperceptible, because since analyzing it, you know, retroactively and looking back on it, I've come to understand that it's not a drug that causes some type of high, whereas you go from feeling normal to feeling, for me, this is exactly how it affected me. I didn't feel very high. In fact, what it did was it removed the part of my mind that would consciously alert me to something being wrong, to something changing. It was almost like I began to feel a void. I felt less than more. I didn't feel more. I felt less. It removed my emotions. I no longer had, slowly over time, I no longer could process emotional response to the stimuli surrounding me. So you could put me in any situation and I would not feel fear. There would be no fight or flight. I would not alter my behavior to avoid danger, because the emotional danger fear response was gone. And this happened, at the point that this happened, I felt like this all day, every day. I didn't feel like this for an hour after taking the pill and then come down from some sort of high. It was a consistent void, a consistent feeling of almost freedom from emotional consequences, the way I is a term I use to explain it. And I'd say this is about a month and a half into using the drug that this occurred.
Now, you're 22 at the time, as I recall.
22 years old.
Just to orient.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
You were 22 at the time, and you'd come home from college, and you were trying to get your head together and your act together.
Absolutely.
So you've got this drug. It's kind of numbing you, but you're giving an even deeper explanation of how it just kind of takes away fearfulness, takes away normal judgment in response to fear, what you're saying it did to you.
Yeah.
I think other people would call that a numbing, or it kind of removes you from yourself. What was the first thing that you began to do that was out of character for you?
Well,
and how long had you been on the drug at that time?
Probably within a month, month and a half is when I began to alter my behavior. And these would be things like entering into social situations that I would normally avoid due to, you know, normal anxiety over the consequences of, I'm sure a lot of guys have had the situation where you see a pretty girl at the bar and you want to talk her up, but, you know, you're nervous. Well, the first thing I would do is I would immediately approach that girl, or immediately put myself in a situation with a group of people who look maybe a little menacing, who I would normally avoid, but confront it, because I didn't feel that anxiety or concern or fear at all whatsoever. So,
see, this is so important, Kevin, because, you could think in the beginning, this is great. I have my, quote, social anxiety disorder under control, but actually your signal system has been disrupted.
Exactly right. At the time, it did seem like some sort of breakthrough. It did seem like I was free of these chains that motivated my behavior. I've since learned that those inner emotional responses that alter my behavior are there for a reason. They're there to protect my survival. And without them, all manner of behavior is possible, put it that way. So those were the first initial differences in my behavior. Shortly after that, I experienced I'm not sure the name, the medical term, but I experienced a very extreme emotional response. One night in my basement, my parents' home, I felt an impending sense of doom. It's difficult to explain because it came from nowhere. There was no initial action that occurred to cause it. I almost couldn't understand it, and yet I'm feeling a need to just run from something. It's almost like a black cloud's over me, and I make a lot of noise, wake my parents up, who come downstairs to see what the problem is. My mother has since told me that she did not see her son when she looked in my eyes. I was not there. They were horrified to the point that they called the police. Something, though, we've had, you know, like any parent child, we've had confrontations. Nothing rising to that level. Nothing rising to the level of needing to bring in a police. But yet, at this point, they felt the need. Who brought me to a psychiatric institute for the night? I was lucid enough at the psychiatric institute to explain that I was on Paxil. I remember very little of this night. I do remember screaming. Actually, you know what? I don't remember it. I screamed, "I'm insane." The only reason I even remember it because it's in the record, and I've since read the record. Yeah.
And of course, you would hope at this point, having read the a little bit of the scientific literature and having a little experience, that these psychiatrists there would say, "Well, maybe this is he's having a reaction to Paxil."
Well,
not a chance, probably.
Now, now looking back, it almost baffles me, but I know how much in the dark even many people in the psychiatric community were. I know that.
And they're still in denial.
I don't know if it's willful or not, and that's, you know, that's another subject, but it is frustrating when the evidence is right in front of your face, and even the drug companies themselves have admitted to much of the evidence, you know. So at this point, it is frustrating, but yeah, no one picked up on that for whatever reason. I was released the next day.
And kept on your Paxil.
Kept on the Paxil. I still had the, I think I'm on another 20 milligram 30 day prescription at this point. I saw the nurse a total of 3 times.
So what happened? Let's look at what eventually got you in trouble.
Okay.
Do you remember it now?
I remember enough of it to piece it together.
I know we spent some time, you and I, piecing together what you did and how it happened.
Yeah.
What did you do? Tell folks what you did.
Well, just 2 weeks after this, I commit a series of armed robberies. And the concept of doing an armed robbery is right now and has always been similar to the notion of me one day landing on the moon. Absolutely impossible. Impossible. There would never be a reason for it financially. I do not have it in my heart.
You come from a well-to-do family. Your dad's a successful businessman.
Yes. Yeah. I've always, luckily, I have a family with financial success.
Actually, I think there was probably more loose change around your house than you were going to get from these gas station stores that you were.
Put it this way, if I did need money and if I ever felt the need, for some reason, hypothetically, to commit some sort of crime for personal gain, this would have been the dumbest thing possibly because I had access to far more money within my grasp at any moment. But it never occurred to me to take that money because there was
Can you bear to describe to people, because of course I've pieced this together and I wrote a legal report on your behalf. Can you just kind of describe people the vignette of what you did?
Absolutely. I have no problem with that.
Describe it. It's unbelievable.
All right. Well, the idea kind of manifested after watching a movie about robberies. Now, I'm not trying to indict in Hollywood here whatsoever because it doesn't. Any stimuli could have influenced me at that point. It's totally different. But my mind was fertile ground to allow a thought like doing an armed robbery to flourish, whereas normally it would immediately be squashed by common sense. But without that emotional fear, without that red flag that goes up automatically, instinctually, in any normal person, without that, the thought of doing an armed robbery becomes kind of self-perpetuates. You think about it. You say, why not? What's really stopping me? And it almost got to the point where I was doing this for no other reason than I physically could.
Let me describe my vision of what you did.
All right.
You went to gas stations. Eventually, how many in number?
Well, 8 in 10 days, and then 9th later on.
Yeah. 8 gas stations in your neighborhood, many of which your family had patronized, many of which you'd driven to in the car you were driving then, using a blue-handled kitchen knife from the kitchen set.
Yes.
You walked in, at times in front of video cameras, and held up these little stores in the gas stations.
Yes.
Meanwhile, the gas stations have men with wrenches and men with heavy tools. You're not a very intimidating-looking person at the time.
No.
And
I was 6 foot and skinny.
And did this again and again in a circle of only a few minutes away from your own home, never imagining, apparently, the ultimate consequences. And that's only the beginning of the absurdity of it all.
Yeah.
But is that accurate, Mike?
That is 100% accurate. That is absolutely 100% accurate.
And then what happens? You get caught, obviously.
I mean,
no way you're not going to get caught. And then the story gets even crazier.
Yes. Well, I get caught, and there's obvious pure devastation within my family and friends, and no one can understand whatsoever what's going on. My family could only point to alcohol use as a possible cause. And although this made absolutely no sense for alcohol to lead me to armed robbery, it was the only thing in their minds that could have possibly been the culprit, so they put me
Well, for one thing, you weren't drunk. No one ever described you as being drunk during the robbery.
You hadn't
been drinking.
But they didn't, you know, they had no idea. And I think they wanted that to be, because nothing else could make sense. They needed to make sense out of that which made no sense. So they pointed to that, and they put me in rehab while I was on bail.
Are you still on Prozac?
Still on Paxil.
I mean, on Paxil. You're still on Paxil?
Still on Paxil. I'm being administered by the various rehabs.
Yeah.
And outpatient.
Nobody stops and thinks, this looks like manic reaction to Paxil. Nobody stops and thinks.
No, and none of my files are following me. So each new nurse practitioner that I meet is kind of, you know, just assuming that whoever prescribed me this stuff knew what they were doing. I guess that's what they were doing. So, yeah, so I'm on bail for 6 to 8 months, at which point I agreed to a 6-year jail sentence. Still completely oblivious, still not affected by this, still just living my life as though none of this is happening. After I agree to the plea, I'm allowed to stay out on bail until I'm going to be a groomsman in my best friend's wedding. So I actually go to visit him in Florida before the wedding, which is about 2 weeks after I agree to the plea. I'm visiting him, and I forget the Paxil. Experience severe withdrawal. Sleeping 18 hours, waking up, not feeling right, disoriented. The entire 7 days there, I progressively was more out of it. When I came home, I just knew that I needed to get back on Paxil. At this point, I'm on 40 milligrams. Each nurse has bumped me up.
Now, did you think you were in withdrawal, or did you just think you needed your Paxil?
I couldn't think straight. The mind was so disoriented that I just was completely out of my, you know, I was out of my mind. I was not able to stop and say something's wrong because I couldn't think enough to do that, you know?
So you couldn't even think, hey, was this withdrawal or do I need these drugs? You just needed the drug.
I mean, I may have understood it as withdrawal. I don't really even remember what I was thinking at that point. It's such
I remember that. So then tell folks what happened.
So I get back on the Paxil a few days later, despite the fact that I've agreed to a 6-year jail sentence. I take the same knife out of my kitchen in the definition of mania, this was pure act. Zero thought. Get in my car, drive to the nearest gas station where I've been to thousands of times, very close to my house. Hold it up. Was chased by about 7 men from the auto mechanic shop, all with wielding, like you said, wrenches and various tools. Get in my car, drive away. I'm spotted, and I get into a police chase, at which point I'm being rammed at 90 miles an hour. There's about 9 or 10 cars behind me, driving through various towns. And I take the knife, and I put it to my neck, and I attempt to end it at that point. I hear a loud popping sound. I assume it's over. I'm not understanding the concept of death. I understand the concept of something ending. The finality and the magnitude of what I'm doing is not being processed whatsoever. It's reflex action. I don't die. I'm still driving. Eventually, I run out of gas. I get out. I'm immediately apprehended. And I'm put in jail now for committing another armed robbery, despite the fact that I have just agreed to a 6-year jail sentence. Now I'm facing possibly the rest of my life in prison. So this was, to say the least, as I'm finally coming off the Paxil for good, the most harrowing experience of my life, the most bizarre experience of my life. And it was as if I was waking up from a dream, because I'm me again. I'm becoming myself again, feeling again. I'm waking up from a dream, but the dream is real, and I have to suffer the consequences for something that it feels like I really, truly did not do. Something else or someone else did. And this is the point, shortly after this, we discover through a conversation, well, actually with myself, having a conversation with another inmate, that Paxil has some sort of side effects. There's something going on with antidepressants, and you have to go on the internet to find out about it. And this is 2003.
It's still true, by the way, that quite often what happens, I'm working on a case exactly like this right now, where the guy's in jail and the inmate tells him, and it's the first time he knows that antidepressants can make somebody crazy, and that's this year.
Yeah, it still goes. Yeah, despite the publicity, there's so much news out there that if you're not looking for something, you might not see it. You know. Yeah, absolutely, and that's what happened to me. We found you very quickly. My mother had to do much of the legwork, if not all of it, because for obvious reasons, I was in jail with no bail and not able to get out at all, and it was very difficult for me to contact anyone. And luckily, we were able to have you come visit, where I could explain what I just said in a little bit of a longer version to you.
Now, you're actually in Medication Madness.
Yes.
What name did I give you in Medication Madness?
You gave me Adam Madison, and I think you did that because I went to James Madison University. I think that might have been the reason for the pseudonym.
You know what? It was unconscious. It was a Freudian slip.
I
never would have purposely
figured
done
that. I figured it was.
Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah.
I never knew that until this moment. Oh, I'm sure it was a Freudian slip.
Okay.
Because I wouldn't give a direct link to your life.
Yeah, but that was esoteric enough. I don't think anyone would have.
Yeah. No, I actually don't think it was conscious on my part.
No,
Now, listen, you're terrific. You're amazing.
Oh, thank you.
We're going to take a break in a minute or two. I want to say that the second part of the hour is in some ways more incredible than the first, when people learn how you have handled this experience and grown from this experience.
Mm-hmm.
So when we return after the break, perhaps we could pick up on perhaps our getting together and the outcome of that, and which was good, but God, not good enough. How much I wished I could just have kept you out of jail altogether.
I know.
We'll talk some about that. I hope that this is going to be a well-listened-to show, that I'm going to do my best.
Okay.
I want to let people know that your story is going to be in the not only archived on PRN, but it's going to be in our next newsletter, which is free, that you can get on empathictherapy.org, empathictherapy.org. Get the free empathic therapy newsletter, and your story is going to be in that. It's a well-done piece that you wrote. And that Kevin will be joining us as on a panel of people who have survived crises brought about by drugs at our next empathic therapy conference, April of 2012. And you can learn about that also on empathictherapy.org. Now I just want to say hello to Giselle, who is the new engineer. And we'll be going to break. And Giselle, you want to say hello, or are you going to stay in the background? Can I get you?
Hello, Dr. Bregan.
Hello, Giselle. Welcome. Giselle's new to PRN, right out of his internship. Congratulations, and let's go to break.
Thank you.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Source for all things progressive.
Today marks the beginning of a beautiful friendship, because the stronger my heart gets, the stronger my pen gets.
Hello, this is Deborah Wolf, best-selling author and award-winning radio host of Animal Magnet Pet Radio. You can listen live to me every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern for the best pet radio in America, Canada, and beyond. Hard-hitting pet issues, animal news, training tips, tricks, games, and quirky pet trivia, plus the A-list pet guests each week. Or listen anytime to past shows at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Listen to this show so you can be good to your animals.
Driving you crazy? Do you have a cheating boyfriend or girlfriend? An ex you can't let go of? An obnoxious boss? Adult kids who won't listen? I'm Hollis Polk, and I fix relationship problems. Your life, your relationship with Hollis Polk offers you practical solutions for all sorts of people problems. Listen and call in Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Pacific, or download the podcast at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Houston, we have a problem.
Hi, I'm Christiane Brown. In today's 24-hour news cycle, most people get about a minute of real truth. Not on the Solution Zone. Every week, I bring in America's best-known activists, bloggers, authors, and politicians to uncover the hidden issues that help separate the truth from the spin.
The Solution Zone with Christiane Brown, every Wednesday at 3 on Progressive Radio Network.
Rachel Trachtenberg for Rachel Trachtenberg's Pure Imagination. This is a show for everyone from our perspective as teens. Current events, art is life, music, and politics. Rachel Trachtenberg's Pure Imagination.
With co-host Julia Cummings.
Wednesdays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Not bad.
Not too shabby.
You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan, and my guest is Kevin McShane. This is a first, this show. It's the first time that I've had on the radio, or really one of the first times I've been on the air. Maybe I've done something on a TV show along the way with a legal client of mine. It's certainly the first time after the person's come out of jail. Kevin was 22 at the time and spent 10 years in jail. It's hugely a first for Kevin. I do believe this is his very first time on the air talking about his experience, and he's doing a fabulous job. It's going to be wonderful to work with Kevin as long as he wants to, in terms of publicizing these issues. How you doing, Kev, with your first radio show?
It's interesting. I'm doing great. I enjoy it.
Ah, that's good. You sound very, very good. Where do you want to pick up?
Well, I guess we can go immediately to, the culmination of the case.
Sure.
Well, quickly, you, after meeting with me and spending a good 6 months doing a tremendous amount of work, you wrote a 26-page report detailing the details of my case and the fact that it was packed for induced mania, at which point we submitted this to the courts. The first thing I had to do was pull the six-year plea because I was copped out. I had agreed to a plea at that point, and it's very difficult to get those back. This evidence was strong enough to show that we didn't cop out knowingly. I didn't agree to the plea knowingly, so therefore the judge did give the six-year plea back, and we started from scratch. Now the ball was in the district attorney's hands. We waited a good 10 months, so I'm in the county prison about 22 months now, which was an incredibly difficult experience, especially knowing that my life was held in the balance the entire time. And the whole goal was that the district attorney would see this evidence, it would be so obvious, and they would no longer pursue the case. But this did not happen. The district attorney wanted to go to trial. Were I to lose trial, I would be receiving a minimum of a 25-year sentence. A minimum. And may have gotten much more. I was given an option to take a 10-year plea. And this was by far the most difficult decision I've ever had to make. I can't even truly say what it was that pushed me towards the plea. It was more of an instinctual feeling that I had to do something here that couldn't put my life in jeopardy. Despite the fact that I knew that my evidence was right and true, and believe me, it was a bitter pill to swallow to accept a plea when you know you're fighting with the truth. I accepted the plea and I accepted the 10-year sentence. We discussed it, you and I, and both of us had difficulty with it because we knew. But we in the end, I made the decision to do something that I knew would allow me to have a life, no matter what. I couldn't put my life in the hands of 12 strangers. So I was transferred then from county jail to state prison.
Do you think, Kevin, that without, I feel badly that you went to jail.
Oh, without your testimony, the cop out, the plea offer would have been a minimum of 20.
Mm-hmm. Without the threat of me going to court.
No question. 10, after committing 8 robberies and then committing a 9th while on bail for the other 8, the judge was absolutely, and rightfully so, absolutely livid. Because he actually did me a favor by allowing me to stay out on bail after the agreement of the plea. Normally, you would be remanded at that point. But since I had come to every court date, he knew my lawyer and such, he allowed me to stay out as a favor. And obviously, I returned that favor by committing another robbery while under the influence of Paxil.
The judgment that you have now is so incredibly balanced. I mean, I could imagine, honestly, that you would have come out of this mad at everybody, including me. What? Do you think it's so great I got 10 years instead of 25? You take 10 years, Doc.
I mean,
your judgment and your generosity, you've become a very mature individual. Maybe you could talk some about that, because we've got 20 minutes left, and I want people to hear just what you've done in your development from this 22-year-old who had this catastrophe on Paxil, which I believe was solely Paxil, not you, and the person you are now. So talk a bit about this growth that you've had, which really impresses me.
Well, I was given a great piece of advice from a fellow inmate very early on. And it was when I was initially experiencing the pain of being in jail and beginning to understand the magnitude of what was happening when I was coming off the Paxil. And I was expressing my frustration. And he pulled me to the side and he said, you seem like a good kid. He goes, you seem very angry right now. And I want to let you know that if you go crazy here, if you lose your mind, no one else suffers but you. All the people you may be angry at, all the people who you want to blame for your problems in any way, shape, or form are not going to suffer for one second. You suffer. So the pain is yours if you choose to allow the anger towards anything else in life to manifest within you. And you have to hold that pain. So you have the decision to say, I don't want to feel like that. I don't want to be angry. I don't want that, regardless of the outside influences in my life. I'm going to choose not to be an angry person, and I'm going to move on with my life, even though I'm in prison. And I did that. There was a lot of time spent alone. A lot of time to reflect, a lot of time to get to know yourself, a lot of sensory deprivation, where you really are in your mind, in a very positive way, believe it or not. I connected with myself. I connected with my family. We had a tremendous amount of time to talk with no distractions. I went back to college. I did very well, almost straight A's, because I enjoyed it thoroughly.
You mean online? You didn't physically go back to college?
No. Well, it was correspondence. No, but I.
Let's remind people you're behind bars.
I didn't have a furlough.
You say it with such enthusiasm. I went back to college.
I know. I was
not
getting
let out
in handcuffs. No, they made me stay in the jail while taking the correspondence courses. I wrote a novel while I was in prison, which is something I've always wanted to do. I met good people. Not all. I met a lot of terrible people and a lot of mentally ill people, but I met a good group of people throughout the... It was actually eight. I wound up doing 8 years and getting 2 years good time. In the 8 years, I was in many different facilities. Ultimately, I came to terms with myself. I learned how to live comfortably in my own mind, regardless of where I was, who I was surrounded by, regardless of all the things that I had no control over at that point. And that's what I had to learn. If you cannot control it, do not let it determine your state of mind. I'm told often by people now, I've been home for 4 months, that I give no sign of ever having been in prison, and I take that as the ultimate compliment. Because I know society's view on what someone should be like after they get out of prison or what they expect them to be like. And it was my implicit goal never to be like that, to actually go in the opposite direction. It's interesting because what was I seeking when I went to see that counselor? I was seeking a way to deal with myself to become a mature adult. And yet, in a roundabout way, and not... because of what she prescribed me, but despite of it, and I ultimately did find that, just not the way I expected it, whatsoever. You know,
the story, your life is such a lesson. You know, you went originally seeking some wise counseling,
yes,
and got toxic drugs. Yes. You go to jail, you get wise counseling from a fellow inmate,
yes,
and it changes your life.
Absolutely.
What does that say about psychiatry, that you're likely to get better treatment from an inmate in jail than from going to the psychiatrist?
Well, in my case, yes. That's absolutely what happened. So anecdotally, I can say I had a much better counselor who did not prescribe me anything that could hurt me and gave me incredible advice, which I took, internalized, and became part of my philosophy. Yes, absolutely right.
Did this man continue a relationship with you? Was he a mentor in prison?
Well,
or was this just a one or two times that he talked to you?
No, early on, but unfortunately in prison it's difficult to maintain relationships. You're so likely to move from one place to another, and at that point you have no contact with someone. So actually, no, this is someone who I never saw again after about 2 months.
Isn't that amazing? Does he have any idea, do you think, his importance in your life?
I don't. I can almost guarantee you he couldn't possibly know how important that was. He may know that he did say something that was right at the time, but to understand exactly how strong an effect that had on me, I don't think he could possibly have.
The issue of personal responsibility is so obviously key to everything in your life and the transformation of your life. And there is simply no greater lesson. All good counseling, all good change in our lives starts with this realization of taking charge of my life, and that going crazy isn't going to do anybody any good, including me or the people I'm enraged at.
Mm-hmm.
That we are our keepers in this sense. And I mean, I'm just really impressed incredibly with how you've done. And it's just going to be such a pleasure to continue working with you. I asked you before the show if you wanted to have a way of people getting in touch with you. Are you still up for that?
Yeah, I have. I can give my email account. I have an email account specifically that people can get in touch with me in any, in any questions or comments that they want to, they might have.
Why don't you give your email then?
Okay, it is aliveandwell11@gmail.com. aliveandwell11@gmail.com.
I love it. I absolutely love it.
Tell me, how I feel.
Just share more of your own thoughts about this incredible development of your own life, and what are you looking forward to doing, and with whom?
Well, okay. Now that I'm, finally home, and the experience of coming home was, unreal. It took me a good 2 weeks to really process that this thing that I have desired and physically yearned for 8 long years is actually here. It was almost surreal. And then the gratitude hit, and I was just on cloud 9 for about a month and a half. Since then, I've integrated. I'm working again, working with my father, who has been absolutely great, as well as my mother, my parents. I've seen both of my sisters. My sister now has a child, so I'm an uncle. There were marriages. The cousins have children. I'm meeting everyone. I'm meeting people who were brought into my extended family's life while I was away and didn't know me, but had heard about me and are very happy to meet me. I've met a wonderful girl who I'm in a relationship with now.
Oh, that's fabulous.
Yes.
Now, you're working for your dad and his business. Is that something you're enjoying that you can imagine continuing to do?
Oh, yeah, it's great. It's a tremendous work environment. We're working in a great office, surrounded by great people. We sell supplements online. It's a very legitimate business. We have good products, so I have a good conscience selling them. It's all nutritional supplements, nothing prescribed. Yeah, it absolutely is something with tremendous growth potential, and it's already a very strong company. I do foresee the possibility of staying here for a long time.
And do you have some thoughts about what you're going to do in terms of reform work? And again, I'm so grateful you were never my patient, because then I couldn't work with you and I couldn't encourage you to do reform work. But you never were my patient. You were my legal client. So I can really look forward to building this relationship. And I think you're pretty excited about having an impact out there.
I absolutely am. And, it is very important to me, and it always will be important to me to get the word out. I do not let my experience torture me. I do not let myself. I'm influenced by it, and I absolutely will, just as anyone has been influenced by the last 8 years of your life in any way, shape, and form. Mine just happened to be a little bit more intense than many. I am very influenced by the fact that I want the world to know, and I want people to know, that these are dangerous drugs. I feel the responsibility to get that word out. It bothers me to the core that people are accepting these prescriptions right now who have no idea, who are just as naive as I was. And I know firsthand what the consequences may be, and I'm lucky to be alive. Some people aren't. So
I have cases of murder on these drugs, of terrible violence on these drugs, and one thought I wanted to clarify for myself and for the audience. You spent 6 years in jail after the an initial two?
Yes.
So basically, your jail term was pretty much, what, another 6 years?
Another 6 years beyond, yes, exactly, which was part of the reason why I agreed to the plea. I knew it would be about six more years and not a full 10. So, it's still a long time, but there
incredibly
was a
long, and you've handled it so incredibly well. We have about 8 or 9 minutes. I want to hear more from you about what you think is important. Any questions of me that you'd like to ask that we haven't gotten around to?
What do I think is important? I think it's important that people understand the strength they have to alter whatever, whatever it is in their lives that is going wrong at any particular time. And this is for, everyone experiences ups and downs, and everyone experiences some sort of depression, be it minor. And some people already know this. But, the power of exercise, I cannot ever underestimate the importance of exercise, because for me, releasing those endorphins and getting out and moving around and functioning, and I was into weight training a little bit when I was in prison, and running and all these types of things. I can't emphasize how important that is. My questions for you would probably be, where do you foresee your advocacy going in the next, 2 to 5 years? And what types of things are you going to be involved in?
no one's ever asked me that. Ginger and I talk about it all the time. I can tell you one project that I'm working on right now, which is the first time I have mentioned it on the air. I'm working on a project called Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, A Practitioner's Guide.
Okay.
Because I think that one of the reasons we're into so much trouble is psychiatrists and nurses who are prescribing these drugs and physicians' assistants, they have no idea that it's hard to come off of them, or they think it's so hard that they never try to take anyone off of them.
Yeah.
And so people end up on them forever.
Yeah.
Because they don't have any approach to taking people off. So they start to take somebody off. The person gets really crazy coming off. They tell the person, see, I told you were bipolar. Or they themselves just don't know what's going on. So my next big writing project is the psychiatric drug withdrawal. I'm continuing, Kevin, to do a lot of legal work, and there are some projects coming up that I think are going to be really, really interesting and maybe impactful on the society, I'm hoping. I just continue doing all the things I've done. I still enjoy my private practice very, very much. And I still think it's important to get out more and more of the word about medication madness, because I keep seeing these cases.
Yes.
Let me tell people just a little bit about the drug and a little bit more about the drug. And then do you have anything further you want to say before I finish up?
I'd like to hear, I've just immensely enjoyed
having you on the show.
I immensely enjoyed being on the show. No, I'd like to hear you speak about Paxil and antidepressants.
Okay. Well, you've been listening to Kevin McShane. You'll be able to read his report in our next empathic therapy newsletter on empathictherapy.org, and you'll be able to see him in April 2012 at the conference. You can find out about that on empathictherapy.org. About these drugs, we're talking about a group of drugs called the SSRIs, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. They block or interfere with the removal of serotonin from the synapse, from the active place in the brain where they're supposed to be working. Basically, it's an attempt to flood the brain with one of its biochemicals. Does that make sense, like it's going to help you? Not a chance. Is that going to fix a biochemical imbalance? Never. It's going to cause them. And in fact, there are no biochemical imbalances in the brains of people who go to see psychiatrists except for the ones the psychiatrist put in there. Kevin McShane did not have a biochemical imbalance in his brain when he was struggling at age 22 with what to make out of his life. But he got a biochemical imbalance the minute he had ingested, within minutes of ingesting the Paxil. This group of drugs includes Prozac, it includes Luvox and Celexa. Effexor is a little different, but it's really all the newer antidepressants, Wellbutrin. They all have the ability to overstimulate the brain. Some brains they'll suppress, others they'll overstimulate. Sometimes they'll do both to the poor person's brain. And they can result in what is a manic-like episode. It's not called a manic episode when it's drug-induced. It's called a substance-induced mood disorder with manic features, and Kevin had a paroxetine or Paxil-induced mood disorder with manic features, and the big manic feature was grandiosity, total loss of judgment, complete disinhibition. Another way of looking at these problems is they're disinhibiting these drugs. They disinhibit, and they can do it especially when the dose has been changed or the drug has just been started. Kevin started to get weirded out within a month or less of starting the drug. Dose changes up or down can do it. You can read that in the drug labels. And drug withdrawal can do it. I was up last night working in the last minute on the criminal case of a man who committed violence 7 days after stopping Sertraline, and it can't be exaggerated. Listen, I'm stuttering. You can't exaggerate the problems that these psychiatric drugs can perpetrate. And if you look at broad examinations, that you go into how many patients in a typical mental hospital have a psychotic manic event on one of these drugs that led to the hospitalization, it can be up to 20%. So we're talking about large numbers of people. The extent of the problem cannot be exaggerated. These drugs are not good for the brain. They don't help people as much as they harm people. And on top of that, the evidence for their efficacy was thin in the beginning, is now disappearing as one after another study shows that if you look at all the combined studies on these drugs, they're no better than placebo. But you see from Kevin's experience how they can mislead you for a while. Hey, I'm anxiety free. I can do anything. Hey, I'm Superman. They can mislead you. I call that medication spellbinding. And I talk about medication spellbinding and these kinds of cases in detail in Medication Madness. This is Dr. Peter Bregan. I'm grateful for my new engineer, Giselle, and welcome him to radio station and to Progressive Radio Network. And I once again thank Kevin McShane for being so brave, for being so honorable, and for being so responsible. And I'm looking forward to working with him for a long time to come. This is Dr. Peter Bregan. This is the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bregan and his lifelong reform work on www.bregan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.